Hi, and welcome to episode number 34 of Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and coming up in a couple of minutes, the final chapter in my interview with Jim Murray. We'll talk about his independence as a journalist and just what's going on with the Whiskey Bible website. First, though, let's check the news. And there's a lot to report from the hills of Tennessee and Kentucky. It's a big weekend in Kentucky, Thoroughbreds and Redheads weekend at Maker's Mark Distillery. The Maker's Mark Mile will be run at Keeneland on Friday, just after Master Distiller Dave Pickerel signs a few thousand special bottles produced just for the occasion.
We try to do a limited number of special bottles a year that are linked to charities that will allow us the opportunity to give back to the community in substantial ways. The bottle that we released for Keeneland this year is one of a series of three that will go to benefit the Marquee Cancer Center in Lexington, and we think that that's going to be a great deal to help them out.
And being Kentuckians, it honors basketball, of course, right?
This year certainly does. This year's bottle is proudly features the picture of the five Rupps runs, with this being their 40th anniversary. And with any luck, maybe we'll get some of them to come and sign the bottles at Keeneland on Maker's Mark Mile Day.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Rupps Runts, that's the nickname for the University of Kentucky basketball team from 1966, coached by Adolph Rupp, that went to the NCAA championship game. That team lost to Texas Western, the first team with five black starters to win the national championship, and the subject of the recent movie Glory Road. History lesson over. The Keeneland event is just the start of a big weekend in central Kentucky.
They actually start lining up at the end of the seventh race that on the day before the signing, and they're there all night long. By the time I get there at like 4 o'clock in the morning, the line already has several thousand people in it.
Which is obviously more than you have bottles of the stuff, right?
No, but it's getting close.
Now, what else goes on during the weekend out there?
Well, you know, so we've got the bottle signing at Keeneland, and then we've got the 10th running of the Maker's Mark Mile, which is a grade 2 stakes race. Then everybody will go and have their dinner, and then we have a big party out in downtown Lexington. Then Saturday we'll adjourn and we'll come to the distillery. And at the distillery, we've got it's kind of like a picnic kind of event. We've got food and music, and we've got a display of how barrels are made. We've got the local cooper shop coming down and building barrels. We've got a demonstration on rotating barrels, and for the ambassadors who have whiskey their name on a barrel, we've actually got some sampling whiskey for ambassadors to see what the 1 and 4 year old Maker's Mark are like.
If you're a fan of George Dickel Tennessee whiskey, it might be worth stocking up on a few bottles of Dickel No. 8 if you see them at your local retailer. Master distiller John Lund says distribution of No. 8 will be limited in the future to make more George Dickel No. 12 available.
The distillery was closed for 4 years, and in reopening, we're needing to replenish. The demand of 12 has been so great that we really want to keep the standard of 12 up. Dickel 8 has been a terrific brand for us, but sustained demand, we're focusing on making sure stocks are available for 12.
Lund was recently promoted from distillery manager to master distiller at the Diageo-owned distillery. Diageo has also reached a goal with Bulleit Frontier Bourbon. You may recall my interview with Tom Bulleit back in January. I caught up with Tom last week at Whiskey Live New York, and his bourbon is now available in all 51 U.S. markets.
We spent a couple years doing that, and Diageo's just done a wonderful job. A long time ago when I had the family company, I was wondering how that was going to work, and it really doesn't work unless you're with one of the large companies.
And you've also gotten a big international following over in Europe, I hear.
We've got a very nice market in Great Britain, and we've traditionally been over in Germany, and we'll expand over there. And we've got a great market in Australia, and we'll be expanding in the Orient, too, and here in due course. To the extent we can, we'll always be a small batch premium bourbon, but it'll grow.
By the way, Tom reports his health has greatly improved. He's been battling cancer for the past several months. Coming up on the events calendar, John Hansel of Malt Advocate magazine will hold another one of his single malt tastings at Monk's Cafe in Philadelphia on the 18th. David Cox of the Macallan will host a very special tasting event on the 20th at the Four Seasons Hotel in Singapore. The World Whiskies Conference for Whiskey Industry Leaders is the 20th and 21st in Edinburgh, and the Whiskey Exhibition 2006 will be April 22nd in Trollhättan, Sweden. There's a complete calendar of events on the WhiskeyCast website at www.whiskeycast.com. Time now for the final chapter of my interview with one of the world's best-known whiskey writers. In the previous two episodes, we heard how Jim Murray pioneered the field of whiskey journalism, as well as his philosophy on what makes a whiskey great and his enthusiasm for blended whiskeys. Now let's close with Jim's thoughts on maintaining his reputation for independence.
Yeah. How hard is it for you to maintain that arm's-length relationship with the people you cover, given that you depend on them for samples at times, and you've worked with them for so long, and you know these people as friends? How hard is it to maintain that level of independence?
Well, if they don't send me the samples, I'd find another way to get them. To be honest with you, I don't find it difficult, because it's easy for me to be absolutely straight, and this probably goes back to my kind of old-fashioned journalistic career. I don't know. There's only myself and Michael Jackson who have actually come from a true journalistic background. Other people who regard themselves as writers have come from other walks of life. So I went through that kind of independent era of being a newspaper journalist, national newspaper journalist. Now, it's difficult from the point of view, I imagine, for a lot of people, from a financial point of view, that they'll say, a company will come on to them and say, look, can you do this and do that and do the other? Well, I've done little booklets for companies. For instance, I did a booklet for Shivers over 10 years ago, when they bought out quite a nice little number and for Duty Free. And I did this little booklet for them that appeared in all the boxes. Now, I've done that for them, but that doesn't mean to say that I like Shivers Regal. And anyone who knows my work knows that I try to keep people, away from that, because I think it's a pretty ordinary and overrated whiskey. Now, okay, I took their money on one hand, and because they asked me to do a particular job, but they're not going to, in any way, shape, or form, get me to say things that I don't believe. I think that is the difficult thing for some people, where they feel that they're dependent on a company. I don't feel dependent on anybody, and I do stuff, there's independent companies who don't have, kind of full blenders, and I go and do work for them. And I charge them by the day, and it's as simple as that. And I've had companies say to me, look, I tell you what, we'll put your name on it, and we'll give you a percentage of the, of the profit. And I've just said, no, I'm not interested. I'll charge you by the day, and we keep it as that. The reason for that is because I don't want anyone to think that I actually make money out of any product that's out there on the shelves. I certainly don't. If I did, it would be under the Jim Murray label, and it would be purely independent and not in association with another whiskey company or rum company or anybody else. It would be a Jim Murray company. Now, I have set these companies up, and they're ready to roll. I just don't have time to do it. But the day will never come when there will be a Jim Murray product where I get a percentage of another company's cut. It's just not going to happen.
Now, you have stretched out, though. Let me just talk real quickly. From what I understand, you're getting into the glassware business now, right?
yeah, that's true.
Somebody on one of the whiskey magazine forums wanted me to ask you about that, because they said, hey, we saw the ad in the current edition of the Bible. What's going on with this?
Well, it's quite simple, really. I think the majority of nose and glasses are too expensive, too fancy, and in many cases badly designed. What I've done is I'm making these things available cheap, so people can not just have one and say, oh, this is my special glass. They can have six or whatever, and they can do vertical tastings in their own home or use them in clubs, in their own whiskey clubs or whatever. They don't have to break the bank to do it. This isn't a millionaire scheme. I'm not going to make hardly anything on this. But I'm using the exact same glasses that I use in my lab for all the tastings that I do with the Bible. And I'm just making the same ones available to anyone who wants to use them. I just think there's too many out there where you are paying for the name, or you're paying for someone's signature on it, or whatever, and it's just way overpriced. I mean, God, you know, if you're working with whiskey, things get smashed. You know, you clean them, or you run water through them, they get smashed, or you drop them, or you knock them over. Don't worry about it. Get another one. You can afford it. You know, that's the way that I'm doing that.
What makes a good nose and glass, in your opinion?
A stem is pretty essential, I think, so you can get your hand under it, for me, so that you can warm it up. When I'm blending corporately, you know, if I'm doing some work for somebody, what I will do is I will select the cask originally and nose from them at full strength, which I don't think anyone else in the industry does. And then I reduce down to the strength that it will go into the bottle. Now, you see, I don't see the point of eventually. I know people reduce down to 20, and there's a good reason for that, because they're doing it all the time and they have to preserve their they have to preserve everything, really. But the fact of the matter is that people, when they buy it, are buying it at 40 or 46 or whatever. So I always work at exactly the strength that it's going to go into bottle. So I know exactly how it's going to be. Now, with a good nosing glass, there's not usually too much room for water because I don't add it. So there's enough for the spirit to sit in the bottom of the glass very, very comfortably. There's enough room for the aromas to collect in the glass, and you can actually pick the aromas out without the alcohol burning through. And so to do that, you tend to use a kind of a tulip shape, and that seems to allow the actual whiskey aromas to hold in that place while the alcohol vapors fly off. There's two types that I prefer, but there's one or two on the market that I'm not great fans of, to be honest.
And the other question that somebody wanted me to ask you is, what's going on with the Whiskey Bible website?
Yeah, and if anyone can give me an answer to that, I'll be grateful for it. Now, I do have actually someone, believe it or not, there is someone in an office next to where I'm sitting now. Well, not at the moment, because it's Sunday, and he's not here today. But there's actually someone full-time on there. But the big problem that I've had, and I can't go into this for one or two legal reasons, but I've just had one or two problems that I didn't envisage. I can't really go into it right now. But my time has been taken up with a particular problem regarding the Bible, has, it's like diverted me away from getting the website sorted. I only have a certain amount of time, unfortunately, because writing the Bible takes 3 to 4 months, absolute solid work. From 8 to 11, 3 to 4 months, absolute solid work. That takes up, a quarter or a third of the year. Then I've got the part of the year where I'm writing, or I'm traveling, where I'm going visiting distilleries. There is not enough days in the year for me. Now, a part of the time was sorted out to be given over to writing the website. Unfortunately, somebody did something this year regarding the Bible which has made that not possible. I can't go any further than that because I've got to be careful what I say here. But there's other things I'm doing at the moment. Let's just say that I'm on the war path very slightly. And I've got to sort this problem out first, and then I can get on with the Bible website But it is coming. It really, really is coming, and it's important for me to come. But unfortunately, there's only one me. There's only 24 hours in a day, and I do try and sleep 8 of them. So there's only so much I can do. And I'm sorry. I do apologize profusely to people who have been trying. Stay in there, guys. It is coming, but I've been detained.
One final question, Jim. Your last glass of whiskey, the last glass you'll ever get, what is it? If you have anything to pick from, what's the last one you choose?
Right, but I was going to say, the last glass of whiskey, I mean, I don't know, that could be a feta can, I could choke on it or something, but there we go, you see, there's my corporate bias. I know that this is another question, but just going back on to marking and upsetting companies and all that kind of stuff. I've known the blender for White MacLeod, Richard Patterson, for many, many years. I mean, I do regard him as a personal friend. In fact, last Sunday, we were in San Francisco and we had a rare time together. We had an afternoon together just chatting and bird watching and just going around the bay. And it was great and we were mates. But although we're buddies, you know, he's really, really pissed because I slaughter Fetican. And the fact that I am not over keen on sometimes the use of caramel that he does, or sometimes certain jurors that have a little bit of sulfur. But he's not happy about that. But even though we're friends, it's not going to affect how I feel about a whiskey. It, you know, friendship, money, all that kind of stuff doesn't make a blind bit of difference. I will only judge it the way I see it. I think you can have friendships in the industry. But at the end of the day, that's not going to have any kind of bearing on how I see the whiskey. Now, just going back onto the actual, the last whiskey. It's that kind of thing where the ship's sinking, isn't it? And there's a bunch of whiskeys out there and you can only grab one. Which one's it going to be? I think what I have to do is probably break open the last bottle of Ardbeg that I have, which I bought, I think, in about 1983 or something like that, in Port Ellen, at the co-op store there, the cooperative store, and it was £10 for the bottle. It is a 10-year-old, so it would have been distilled in around about 1972, something like that. And it's the old Ardbeg. It's an Ardbeg which today you can't taste. In fact, it's a whiskey style. There is nothing close to it today. And when people taste the 1974 Ardbeg or 77, these are the ones that consumers are really, really in love with. And then they're getting some kind of idea of this. But at 10 years old, it just seems to be the perfect age for it. The amount of oak and the peat and the different type of peat just seem to have married in a particular way that if you waved a wand at it and did all kinds of chanting for 2 days around it, you could not get it any better. And this is probably the last whiskey I would ever want to have because it was the whiskey that absolutely opened my eyes 20 years ago and made me think, wow, this stuff can just be something that truly changes your life. And it would take me back to that wonderful time of discovering.
If you're looking for a copy of the 2006 Whiskey Bible, contact Jim through the Whiskey Bible website. That's all for this edition of Whiskey Cast. My email address for feedback and questions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2006, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.